Welcome to the deep dive. So you've given us this, I mean, a really fascinating collection of sources today. We're talking about compassion, but it feels like we're going way beyond just, you know, being nice. This is about the psychology, even the neuroscience of kindness.
Exactly.
And how it's like a shortcut to getting what you actually want in life.
That's the mission today, really.
Yeah.
We're going to move past that surface level idea of compassion.
Okay.
We'll define it, look at the hard science behind its benefits, and then get into some really actionable techniques.
And then connect it all back to that internal struggle, right? The heart versus the mind thing.
That's the core of it. That battle that holds us all back when we're right on the edge of growing.
So let's nail down that definition first, because the sources seem really careful to separate compassion from, say, pity.
They are. And the core idea is that compassion is an active state. It's about being affectionate, empathetic, caring for people unconditionally.
So it's not just seeing someone suffer.
No, it's the active desire to help reduce that suffering.
And it seems like all the sources really line up on this one point. It has to start with self-compassion.
Oh, absolutely foundational. It's all about learning to be kind to yourself, especially when you fail.
Instead of that inner critic just taking over.
Exactly. Instead of comparing yourself. And the sources are so clear. Self-compassion isn't just a nice to have. It's the prerequisite.
You can't pour from an empty cup.
You really can't.
Yeah.
As you build up that internal kindness, your ability to give it to others it expands automatically.
Okay, so I want to get into the science of this. Because it's one thing to say be kind, but what does the data actually show? What are the benefits on like a biological level?
The list is, it's pretty extraordinary. And surprisingly, it's good for you.
Right.
Practicing compassion can make you happier. It can literally make you feel more attractive. And it's directly linked to better health and even a longer life.
Wow.
Yeah. This isn't just for saints. It's a survival mechanism.
And this is where the neuroscience really just elevates the whole conversation, that research from the National Institutes of Health.
This part is truly mind-bending. The NIH found what they call the warm glow effect.
Okay.
They found the parts of the brain that light up when we experience pleasure, you know, food, money, that kind of thing.
The reward centers.
The reward centers. They are equally active when we see someone else get that reward.
So wait, if I watch a video of someone giving a huge donation to charity, my brain gets a little hit of that same joy.
That's what the science says. It's a biologically rooted shared pleasure.
That's amazing.
And it suggests there's a deep evolutionary reason for it, which is backed up by that other study from the University of British Columbia.
With the kids, right.
Yeah, with children as young as two. They show that the toddlers got a bigger happiness spike from giving treats away than they did from receiving them.
That just reframes everything, doesn't it? It suggests compassion isn't something we have to force ourselves to do.
It suggests it's an evolved preference, hardwired in us for social bonding, for the survival of the species.
And that suppressing it is actually bad for our health.
Exactly. And that perspective lets you kind of reframe judgment. You can start to see it as no bad people, just bad behaviors.
Which would naturally make you more compassionate. It's a feedback loop.
A very powerful one.
Okay, so we've established it's necessary, it's good for us, it's baked into our biology now. The how, we need the tools.
Right.
And the sources gave us some great frameworks, starting with psychologist Kristen Neff.
Neff's work is so important because she just breaks it down into these manageable steps. The first one sounds simple, but it's the hardest for a lot of us.
Treat yourself like a good friend.
That's it.
And I loved the example and the source. You know, if your friend loses a promotion, you don't tear them down.
Of course not. You comfort them, you take them to lunch, you remind them how great they are.
But when it's us,
we do the opposite. We criticize, we punish ourselves. The whole exercise is just to pause and offer yourself that same loving kindness.
Maybe even say the words out loud to yourself in a mirror.
That can be incredibly powerful, yes.
And for when you're really in the middle of a struggle, she has the self-compassion break. How does that work?
It's designed to interrupt that negative spiral. When you feel that stress rising, you pause and you use a few key phrases.
Like what?
First, you just acknowledge it. This is a moment of stress. Then you give yourself permission. It's okay that I'm struggling. This hurts, but I'll get through it.
And then the last part is so important.
The common humanity part. You say, everyone struggles sometimes. You are not alone. It pulls you out of that feeling of isolation.
That idea of shared experience is a perfect bridge to the next tool, the loving kindness meditation.
Yes, from Emma Seppala at Stanford. It's this beautiful, structured way to expand that feeling of compassion outward.
So you start by grounding yourself, focusing on your own well-being, and then what's the first step outward?
You start to visualize. You imagine someone close to you on your right sending you love, and someone on your left. Soon you're surrounded by all these people sending you warmth and care.
You're just receiving it.
You're receiving it. Centering yourself in that safety. And then you start to generate it back.
And this is where that mantra comes in.
Exactly. You repeat these simple phrases for each person. May you be well and happy. May you be free of pain.
May you be peaceful. May your heart be filled with love.
That's it. And after your inner circle, you expand to, say, a good friend or a relative.
Then comes the part that feels like a real emotional workout, extending it to someone you feel neutral about?
Right, like a cashier at the store. And that's an important step because it forces you to recognize their humanity beyond their function in your life.
Just seeing them as a person who also deserves peace.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which prepares you for the final boss, let's say.
A person you dislike, or even an enemy.
And that takes real work. You have to focus on positivity over hatred and just repeat those same phrases for them. It's not about letting them off the hook.
It's about letting yourself off the hook.
It's about releasing that toxic grip of negativity that's only hurting you.
And then the last stage is just...
everyone. You send it out globally. The sources talk about this creating a sort of butterfly effect, these ripples of positive energy spreading out.
That foundation of self-compassion, of being able to generate loving energy. It leads us so perfectly into the other major theme from the sources, the psychology of desire. Of being able to actually receive the good things you want.
This is the profound connection. Self-compassion builds self-trust. And you need that trust to override your mind's safety protocols when you try to grow.
Okay, so let's talk about that conflict. The battle between the heart and the mind. Can you break down their roles?
Absolutely. The sources describe the heart as the visionary. It knows your next step. It's your future speaking.
And it speaks in whispers, right, in invitations.
Whispers and invitations, yeah. To receive a new chapter or more abundance or just rest.
And the mind, on the other hand, is always looking backward.
Always. The mind only knows your past. It's history echoing. Its only job is to protect you, to predict pain based on what's happened before.
Based on old, outdated information.
Exactly. So it will recall every past failure, every disappointment, to try and keep you small, because small feels safe.
So you get that pull, that exciting but also terrifying feeling about making a big change. That's not confusion.
That's not confusion. The sources call it alignment meeting limitation.
I love that phrase.
It's perfect, isn't it? Your heart says, let's go, let's expand. And your mind says, whoa, remember what happened last time? What if we get hurt?
And that's the friction point for all growth.
It is. So the key insight for you, the learner, is this. You're not unready. You're just unfamiliar.
And unfamiliar doesn't mean unsafe.
Unfamiliar is not unsafe. The fear is just a ghost. It's old data.
Which is why the sources say that manifestation or receiving isn't a mindset trick. It's a nervous system skill.
A nervous system skill. That's the whole game.
So how do you practice that? How do you build that skill?
You have to make your mind feel safe enough to trust your heart. You have to practice allowing more in very small, regulated doses.
So you don't just jump into asking for $1 million?
No. You start by allowing yourself to take a full hour for lunch. Or you allow yourself to accept a compliment without deflecting it. Every tiny act of receiving comfort and growth teaches your nervous system that expansion is safe.
So to bring this all together, let's look at how leaders are applying this on a, you know, a global scale. The TED Talks in our sources were really powerful.
They were. Tim Dawes, for example, he reframes compassion as a type of power.
It's a skill.
A teachable, repeatable skill that gets better outcomes in business and in life. And he told that incredible story about the man with the gun.
Who put it down after he was just offered a drink and a hug?
Simple human connection. It wasn't pity. It was an act to alleviate suffering in that exact moment.
And then Dr. James Doty really drove home the biology of it all.
Mm-hmm. His work confirms that compassion lowers stress. It reduces inflammation markers. It increases longevity. And he traces his whole life back to one single act of kindness he received when he was a kid.
It just reroutes your entire life.
It can. And Joan Halifax adds that compassion doesn't drain us, which is a common myth. She says it enlivens us.
It boosts the immune system. It enhances neural integration.
Which basically means it helps all the different parts of your brain talk to each other more effectively.
That makes so much sense. If your nervous system feels safe because of self-compassion, you're not wasting all this energy just protecting yourself.
Exactly. You have the full capacity to move toward the future your heart actually wants for you.
Before I wrap up, let's just quickly hit that final crucial distinction again. Empathy versus compassion.
Right. They're related, but they're different. Empathy is feeling with someone, putting yourself in their shoes.
And compassion is?
Compassion is the action step. It's the desire to help, the need to reduce their suffering. Empathy is the input. Compassion is the output.
This has been such a cohesive deep dive. It's so clear that you can't really have external kindness without mastering internal kindness first.
I think the biggest takeaway is that self-compassion, practiced with tools like that meditation, is really the foundation for self-trust.
And that trust is what lets you receive the growth you want. It's about letting your heart guide you, even when your mind is screaming about the past.
Because the mind predicts from history, but the heart directs from potential.
And the sources have this beautiful description of how every time we practice this, we send out these ripples of radiant energy that we're contributing to a universal consciousness of these good feelings.
Yeah.
So the challenge to you, the listener, is to think about this. If receiving is a nervous system skill and self-compassion is what settles that system, where is the most unfamiliar, most exciting desire waiting in your life? And what's one small safe thing you can allow yourself to do today to start building that pathway toward it?